small stage.
I think it's much more interesting to live not knowing than to have answers which might be wrong.
It's not really about going to another star system. It's about how do we improve life here on Earth.
Not only the question, but the way you try to solve it.
Beauty at this dimension, 1 centimeter, is also beauty at a smaller dimension.
Hello and good evening. You're listening to UBC Sharing Science Radio, broadcasting from CITR 101.9 FM on unceded Musqueam territory at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. Sharing Science Radio is here to bring you a weekly dose of science news, discussion, interviews, and local events. I'm your host, Sam Livingston, and with me today are Tanya and Emil. On tonight's show, we're going to talk about the process of recycling and its effect on the environment and humans in general. Let's hear first from Tanya.
In the past, we recycled everything. Well, almost everything. Before the Industrial Revolution, things like bottles were almost as valuable used as they were new. Bottles were hand-filled and hand-capped, and people generally owned a few bottles of their own, which they filled, used, and washed throughout their lifetime. If you fast forward to the early days of mass production, bottles were still too expensive to throw away. Producers pressed their logos right into the bottles they made and used a deposit refund scheme to ensure that people returned their bottles after use. It wasn't until after the Second World War that mass production became efficient enough for us to really move into the disposable economy. By that time, it was finally cheaper to make a bottle, use it once, and throw it away than it was to recycle the bottles which were already made. Of course, if something makes economic sense, it doesn't necessarily also make environmental or social sense. As the disposable culture grew, so did the landfills. Through the 50s, 60s, and 70s, landfills were operated in an ad hoc manner by individual municipalities. Little to no regulation meant that toxic leachate, which is basically the gross juice which forms as garbage decomposes, could easily end up in the groundwater and from there in the drinking water or local swimming hole. The trash itself might be poorly contained and blow around in the wind, landing elsewhere in the landscape. And dangerous items, like toxic or biological waste, were as easily disposed of in the trash as a banana peel. Meanwhile, the environmental movement was growing. Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, the vivid imagery of defoliants used as weapons in the Vietnam War, and visibly growing pollution throughout the landscape helped to catalyze a movement. The idea that man was having a negative impact on the environment took hold. In a rare moment for American culture, public opinion seemed to be unanimous that we needed national environmental policy. To this end, Nixon signed a bill called NEPA and thus created the EPA on New Year's Day, 1970. 2 months later, the first Earth Day celebration took place and cemented environmentalism's place in the national consciousness. In the late 70s, as the EPA was trying to enforce some clean water and other policies, the issue of leachate from landfills became apparent. New regulations were put in place to require landfills to contain the leachate, and those meant new landfills with different construction. Most operating landfills couldn't meet the specs as they were. They would have to close, and new ones would have to be built at great expense to meet the standards. Within 10 years, over 60% of the nation's dumps had closed, and it seemed like a crisis was looming. Suddenly, communities everywhere were scrambling to find a place to put their trash. An obvious solution was to reduce the amount of trash in the first place. To do this, the clear choice was recycling. More recycled goods meant less trash to send to those seemingly scarce landfills. So communities began experimenting with recycling. The early attempts did not go well. The first problem was that there wasn't the right science or engineering in place to really make it happen. We had all sorts of processes and technologies which were very good at taking a natural resource like ore and refining it and turning it into something like steel. Not so much with recycling. We didn't know how exactly to take an old glass bottle and clean it perfectly and get the glue from the label off well enough and so on to get pure glass to melt back down into another glass bottle. Plus, all the different colors were mixed together and on and on. It was even harder for things like plastic, of which there are many different varieties, or paper, which tended to disintegrate while it was on its way to the recycling plant. On top of that, manufacturers had very strict requirements for their raw inputs, and most recycled materials couldn't meet these specs. It took a few decades, lots of failed experiments, and a ton of really ingenious engineering, but we are finally getting to the point where recycling makes both economic and ecologic sense. Automation, mostly developed by European companies, can now take a single bin of all sorts of recyclables and sort it appropriately using lasers, magnets, and scales to detect density, magnetic properties, and light absorption. The materials derived from these processes are cheaper and better for manufacturers, and the process costs less overall than the raw resource extraction and processing. Ecologically, for most recyclables, it costs less energy and produces less pollution over the total life cycle to recycle certain products than it does to produce them new. And it keeps the stuff out of the landfill. Aluminum cans are a shining example, excuse the pun. A recycled can costs 95% less energy than a can produced from new aluminum mined from the earth. Still, we have a ways to go in North America. Europe is leading the pack with nations like Sweden claiming 90% household waste diverted from the landfills. Canada and the U.S. lag behind, both hovering around 30%.
Apparently, all those bottle drives I did as a kid didn't really contribute very much to Canada's statistics. What do you have for us, Emil?
We all know that there are many ways of recycling. Government and municipalities are making their best effort to increase recycling from households and industries. But looking at this from a scientist's perspective, one might ask, what is the best way to recycle? And more importantly, how can we measure which is the best method? Consider you throw away a battery in the correct bin at the recycling station. What will happen next with that battery? How far will it travel until it reaches its final resting place, and which CO2 footprint will this leave? A research group at MIT set out to answer this question in 2009 in a large study called Trash Track. The study tracked more than 2,000 different pieces of trash from households in Seattle using electronic tracking devices attached to the trash. These tracking devices would then periodically transmit signals to report its location, and the results they found was astonishing. While the majority of the trash found its final resting place in the vicinity of Seattle, in some cases, items traveled across the whole country. The most extreme case appeared to be electronic waste such as cell phones, batteries, and printer cartridges. A cell phone would on average travel a mere 831 kilometers, but in the maximum case, the distance was recorded to 4,825 kilometers. That's about the distance between Vancouver and Toronto. Similar distances were recorded for toxic and hazardous waste such as batteries, fluorescent light bulbs, and printer cartridges. And the grand winner was the printer cartridge, which in some cases found its way all the way to the Mexican border. In conclusion, toxic waste is associated with long transportation, thus a large amount of greenhouse gases. You might then say, doesn't the transportation neutralize the whole purpose of recycling then? Well, these products are mainly recycled in order to prevent toxic material from ending up in the nature, and transportation is therefore well justified and necessary. But still, it is an eye-opener to see how far these waste products travel. And to get it in perspective, transportation of the average printer cartridge produces 90 times more greenhouse gases than the average recycled newspaper. E-waste is currently 2% of all waste, and transportation accounts for 80% of the emissions during the recycling process. From my perspective, with the amount of e-waste increasing by the day, it seems that there are room for improvement in this sector to reduce the emissions in the recycling process of these goods. It would seem reasonable to have more local facilities maybe to take care of these products to limit the amounts of greenhouse gases in the recycling process.
All right, thanks for that, Emil. It's really backwards to think that there's a lot more of the greenhouse gases that are being produced in the transportation of our garbage instead of the actual destruction of the garbage. My story is a little bit less of a study story and more of a life cycle story. For the last several years, I've had the chance to think about and study the life cycles of various animals, plants, and bacteria, but I've never thought about the life cycle of the plastic pop bottle that I probably drink one too many of. It's usually out of my hands and into the recycling bins before I even have a chance to think about what happens next, so I'm going to spend a minute or two talking about the behind-the-scenes recycling. Once in the recycling bin, the mixture of various recyclable materials is shipped off to a sorting facility that relies on mostly manual labor by people to sort the various categories of recycling. Most soft drink bottles are made of polyethylene terephthalate, which is just a fancy name for polyester, and are quite different chemically from other synthetic polymers, such as PVC plastic, which is commonly used for piping. Once sorted into their respective huge piles of plastic, they are crushed into bales and sold by the sorting company as a commodity to other companies wishing to reuse the material. Because these bottles are slightly porous, which means that little bits of the food or drink it once contained is stuck inside the wall of the bottle, they need to be melted down into their chemical constituents to get rid of the undesirable food products. This company will then use the broken down plastic in various other products, namely carpets, clothing, plastic furnitures, or incorporated into new soft drink bottles. Efficiency of polyester recycling is highly variable, ranging from a few percent to as much as 80% of the original bottle ending up in the new product in one way or another. However, the mixing of different plastics and not sorting properly can ruin an entire batch of melted down polyester, resulting in a huge waste of energy and non-biodegradable material. Keep that in mind the next time you're going to recycle your bottles. We're going to take a quick break and hear from our sponsors, and then we'll start our discussion on the various topics of recycling.
The Vancouver Queer Film Festival runs this year from August 13th to 23rd. Check out spotlights on homebrewed Canadian craft, deeply moving Latin American films, gender debunking heroes, and a ton of youth-rated films. For more information, as well as tickets, six packs, and super passes, visit queerfilmfestival.ca.
All right, welcome back. You're listening to UBC Sharing Science Radio on 101.9 FM CITR. Let's start this discussion off with a little bit of brutal honesty. How much do you guys recycle?
I recycle all the time.
I do my best together with my roommates. And that is sometimes a mixed results, but I try to make as good an effort as I can when I bring down all the recycle to the recycling room. In the basement, yeah. But when I'm around on campus and I've had lunch out somewhere or having a bottle, it's quite easy to find the correct bin to throw it away in.
UBC seems to be pretty good at that, having a lot of available trash cans and garbage cans and recycling bins to be able to sort all of your recycling out.
Yeah, it's pretty good. But Sam, you never answered the question.
I'm pretty bad, to be honest. I tend to use a lot of plastics and a lot of recycling bottles, but not all the time does it end up into the recycling bin. And that's a bit of a shameful secret for me.
Why is that?
Well, for me, I drink a lot of soda and soft drinks. So whenever I'm having to drink one of these, I have to buy a new pop bottle at the convenience store. And that means that it's a new bottle every single day and another one that will hopefully end up in the recycling bin. But I don't have the option to refill my soda into a take-home water bottle or something, so I have to buy a new one every time.
You're just a victim of the system, man.
At least I like to play the victim anyways. But I've seen a few of these Coke vending machines that you have the option of creating your own Coke soft drink. And I saw this at the movie theaters in Richmond, actually.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, you get to do like mixtures of like orange and Coke, and they've got a ton of different flavors. And I'm wondering if they're going to be able to expand that to be able to fill your own take-home water bottle to go instead of having to use a new plastic bottle every time.
Well, recycling is a hard problem because I think ultimately people always just tend to do what's the most convenient and the cheapest. And until we figure out something which really works, like where it's just really cheap and really easy, it's not super going to stick. Like, someone like me can be all hoity-toity in my first world country with recycling bins everywhere that I recycle, but it's not so easy for everyone else, and it's not really so likely, you know? So until we find disposable bottles that melt in 2 days or something like that, that don't spill your pop everywhere before you're done drinking it, I'm not sure what we're really going to do.
I also actually think that even though people would be able to bring their water bottle to fill, like their own pop bottle and fill up, would people really do that? I mean, like would you want to have your Coke in a transparent water bottle thing? Even though like cafes offer you some small discount to bring your own cup, I still think a lot of people want to carry around that white mug with the green logo on it. Not to mention any names here. There's like so many feelings and attached to the bottles and the cups themselves. To, like, get rid of that.
Yeah, I wonder if the marketing plays a little bit of a role in that. For me, yeah. I don't really care less because it's. I know, I'm going to be drinking it anyways. It only lasts for about 10 seconds in my hand. But we should. I think there should be some other option, at least, to be able to get rid of the excess number of bottles that we use. And on the topic of what Tanya was saying, I think we should even move away from a reward system where you're you get your 10 cents back for recycling a bottle.
To penalizing systems.
Exactly, yeah. Higher consequences. I mean, we have fines for recycling and garbage ending up on the ground. I've never met anybody that's actually been fined for it, but it exists apparently. But it should be much harsher.
Well, like, if you ask an economist, they would say tax something you don't want to have, and then that thing will go away. But if you look at the real economy of disposable goods, you're probably better off punishing the actual producers versus the consumers, because the consumers are given very little choice about what they purchase. Like in your case, you have to buy a new bottle every time you want a pop. And if we punish the producers, they have a lot of resources and a lot of smart people working for them. It's likely that they would come up with a better solution to save themselves money and do better by the earth. But that would take some pretty visionary legislation and some prime ministers who maybe care a little more about the environment.
I feel like it would receive a lot of opposition. There might be a little bit of lobbying from the soft drink companies.
Yeah, big business wouldn't be very happy about some legislation that would hurt them economically in the short term, even though it might lead to some really big innovations. They have done that in the past. I think Europe has started to do that more recently, but we'll see how that really pans out.
There's actually a market for plastics and waste removal from countries like North America and Europe, where China's actually importing 3 million tons of plastic waste every year for them to process, sort, and then resell back to the countries that it was received from, or to use it in its own domestic economy. This kind of falls into what Emil was bringing up in his articles, where there's transportation of wastes around the country. And why aren't we just dealing with it at the source of the garbage? Why don't we have waste facilities to be able to deal with e-waste, like our cell phones that are ending up in Mexico? Why aren't they just being dealt with in Seattle, where we don't have the transportation costs?
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. I gotta say, I'm not really had the full picture of this, but I guess there's a lot of financial incentives here where people are willing to pay for something somewhere, and the transportation, I'm not really considered part of that, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or the cost is low compared to, like, for example, in Seattle, opening some kind of plant would be really expensive because the land's expensive and the labor's expensive and there's all sorts of regulations about how to build a building safely and so on, versus maybe opening one in China or Mexico where the environmental regulations are more relaxed, the labor is cheaper, and even just the building regulations are a little looser.
It does seem a little bit odd. I remember a friend of mine who's a fisherman. He'll go fishing in the North Atlantic or in the North Pacific, and they'll have all of the fish sent to China for them to process into, I guess, fish sticks or into the cans, and then it's transported back to Canada, North America for it actually to be sold retail. And it seems so odd that it's more economically viable to send it off to an entirely different continent and then have it brought back afterwards instead of just, you know, setting up a practice where it's done in-house.
Yeah, absolutely. It is more economically viable. Like your T-shirt, for example, the cotton might have been made, which I do notice has a Coca-Cola logo on it.
Hey.
Anyways, Sam's Coca-Cola T-shirt aside, the cotton could have been grown in Egypt or in America, and then it would be spun in India, and then it would be shipped somewhere else for being made into a T-shirt. It might be dyed somewhere else and then finally shipped back to America. It could travel the world a couple times just in the process of being made. And yet, it still costs only like $5 or $10 to make a T-shirt.
Well, there's the economic incentives to not dealing with our own problems.
Absolutely. It's the North American way. I mean, you could argue that once we have electric cars or solar power powering our truckers, then we won't need to worry about shipping things all over the place. Mm-hmm. But that's not a super good argument for the short term, because we absolutely don't have that technology right now. And so we should be looking at more efficient ways in terms of greenhouse gases and impact on the environment for really making our recycling meaningfully better for the earth.
In terms of the recycling process, it was interesting that you brought up that there are automobile companies in Europe that are actually automating the sorting process for recycling. And something that is very important for the recycling process is making sure that each individual recycling material is isolated from one another so as not to mix them together and cause contamination between the processes. So when Tanya brought up that it was going to be automated, or at least semi-automated, using light, density, and several factors, that is really streamlining the process that is used in recycling and the process of being able to reuse all these materials. Because right now it's economically viable to send it to China, where the sorting process, which has to be done by people, is much cheaper. Whereas if we use this automated process, a lot of those things can maybe be done in countries.
Yeah, absolutely. And unfortunately, it's a bit of a hurry up and wait, because it's pretty difficult technology to quickly, easily, and cheaply sort out different kinds of plastic. It's not so hard to separate the metal from the glass, from the plastic, and from the paper, because all four types of material are so inherently different. But to separate out PVC from some other combination of weird letters is a whole different task indeed, and it will take some pretty ingenious engineering to make that easy, quick, and cheap.
Mm-hmm. Do you think we might see recycling engineering in the future? I mean, like, we have at UBC, we have forestry or all different types of specializations. Will we see people specialized in the engineering behind recycling maybe in the future?
That's a super good question. I see that happening for sure, as long as we incentivize that to happen. So if we have legislation and social structures that make recycling part of our landscape here in North America, then I totally see that becoming a new stream in engineering schools around the nation.
Absolutely. And I think bioplastics is really starting to take off as well. And it reminds me of one study that a 16-year-old did for a science fair project in Ontario. It was this, a really ingenious 16-year-old kid. He wanted to see what would degrade a plastic bag. So he ended up doing a 3-month study on his own. This was, I'm not sure if this was for a class project or something extracurricular.
He was a high school kid?
He was a high school kid, 16 years old. And he, using different levels of different amounts of soil that he got from his backyard, he ended up finding a specific bacteria that was able to dissolve a plastic bag over the course of 3 months. And he received $30,000 from the government of Ontario to fund his university studies whenever he was going to make it to that point. And it's really amazing that we can find these bacteria that are able to degrade plastics when they're such a strong material and so high in energy, that we need these bacteria to be able to dissolve the massive amounts of plastic that's in our oceans and sitting in our landfills right now. I think that requires a lot more incentives from the government to fund that study.
Well, yeah, like maybe more than just the first few weeks of tuition at Harvard.
Yeah, exactly.
No kidding.
But yeah, that's a cool discovery, and that might be a way forward for us. But plastic is a huge problem in general, because we get plastic from petroleum products. It's a byproduct of making gasoline and jet fuel. And that whole process in itself is pretty inherently polluting and bad for the earth, at least just in terms of greenhouse gases. Just in terms of greenhouse gases, it's awful. And then there's all sorts of other things, like the tailings ponds, the mining, the drilling, and so on. So our dependence on plastic is a little bit scary. We really do need it in medicine. It's really hard to imagine replacing plastic in medicine. But we don't necessarily need it in consumer goods. If we're going to move away from fossil fuels, we're going to have to also move away from plastic. And I'm not exactly sure how we'll pull that off.
I'd be really interested to see our community and our lifestyles live without plastic. Everything
it's
around
everywhere.
Us uses it. Yeah. I can't think of anything that isn't at some point using plastic from the production of any other natural product in the world. It somehow, and some place in the process, uses plastic. We can't get away from that.
No, it's super hard to imagine. I don't know what we'll do.
I mean, what did we do before?
Glass bottles, as we talked about before.
Yeah, glass bottles.
But they're really heavy. I mean, like, if you're going to ship a bottle of water, it's going to have a lot of that weight will put into the glass. Still have to be washed, get off the labels, get new labels on it. Then recycling definitely needs to include less transportation than if we use glass more. So.
And I saw that glass was the least energy-efficient reusable product compared to aluminum and plastics.
It's pretty bad. And just like the colors alone, the fact that they make glass in different colors is really hard, because then when you recycle it all together and it gets ground up into just a big mix of blurb.
And nobody wants a blurb mix.
No, nobody wants that color.
No.
They're actually finding new uses for recycled glass. It's kind of like downcycling. So instead of an aluminum can, you can recycle and turn it into another aluminum can. And in principle, you can kind of do that infinitely. Once you have enough aluminum cans in the world, you never have to mine any more bauxite to make aluminum, and you can just keep recycling your aluminum. But with glass, it's pretty different. Right now, we mostly use ground-up glass in roads, actually. We mix it. We grind it up and then make the edges soft and mix it in with asphalt.
Cool.
And that acts as the filler instead of gravel.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's
interesting. Cool.
Is it more efficient to use the glass instead of the other filler?
Yeah, because we have to, like, get gravel from somewhere, whereas we've got tons of ground-up glass. It's cheap. It's light. It's the right texture and shape and weight.
And something I didn't realize until I actually read the name of it, but polyester, when we are downcycling, because as Tanya said, it's not true recycling of plastic bottles. When we downcycle the plastic bottles that we drink from, most of it ends up in our clothing as the fiber filler of polyester clothing or in the furniture. And it gets really interesting to see that you can take something that is so, like, the malleable plastic bottle that holds our food and drinks, and it's actually going to end up in our clothes at some point. The likelihood of us buying clothes that have what's considered virgin plastic, where it's never been used in another product, I think it must be very low compared to any of our other products, because why would we end up wanting to use fresh virgin plastic in our clothes when it doesn't really matter what's in there?
Maybe we'll end up as, like, the high-end clothing, like, it's virgin plastic.
Gucci will learn the next
virgin plastic shirt. It's super soft.
When we stop making petroleum products.
Yeah.
So never, right?
Yeah,
never. Yeah, I mean, that's another kind of problem with recycling. Like, recycling is better than not recycling and just chucking everything into the landfill, but we still have a lot of bugs to work out in terms of being good stewards of this planet. When you recycle plastic and make it into fibers, you basically decrease the particle size, and the tiny little shards and beads of plastic are causing a huge issue in our oceans and waterways. They're kind of invisible. They get to be microscopic in size. They break down and get smaller and smaller, and then microorganisms ingest them, bigger fish ingest those, and things end up getting sick and full of plastic, like all of the living things in our oceans and waterways, because the plastic that they're eating isn't the size of a garbage bag anymore, or the, you know, stereotypical Coke can rings. Mm-hmm. It's just so small that they can't see it, and it's killing everything.
And getting stuck in their gills so they can't breathe anymore either.
Yeah, it's awful.
Didn't the government of Canada recently just put forth a bill that's actually trying to get rid of the microbeads in hair products? And
yeah, I think they did in cosmetics. I think Elizabeth May probably wrote that, but someone should check my facts there. I have no idea if it passed or not. It really should, but that's great. And using it in cosmetics is pointless, but it's not really going to help the fact that most of the plastic that we recycle gets downcycled in a similar way.
Mm-hmm. So what are our take-homes for today, then? What do we need to really pay attention to when it comes to our recycling recycling responsibilities as individuals and a society?
I think the simple thing is just do it. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of naysayers out there who are like, oh, it costs more energy to recycle, blah, blah, than it does to make a new one. And that's only true in, like, 5 or 10% of the situations. And if you don't know each individual situation, you're best to just recycle everything, because that's the best option that we have. It's kind of like democracy isn't perfect, but it's better than all the other options.
Yeah. Well, I can assure you I'm probably going to be recycling every single one of the pop bottles that I drink. And maybe I'll just stop drinking pop altogether.
Yeah. Win, win, win.
Yeah,
yeah. Don't aim too high.
I'll start slow.
Yeah, but in the end, I think it's just make small steps and do things that are quite easy for yourself, like bring your own coffee mug to the coffee place and try to use recyclable containers and, yeah, minimize those waste products as much as you can.
And just be aware that every time that you get to go food or get a coffee, that is something that's going either to the landfill or to a possibly inefficient recycling process. And think about the products that you buy. I mean, you can vote with your dollar probably a lot more effectively than you can vote with your actual vote.
That's a great take home right there. If you're really feeling bold, you can write into the government and really show your support that you want to see some more change in policy and change in the way that the government is spending their money. Do you want them to be promoting through tax cuts your favorite soft drink provider, or do you want to see the change that you hope in every single individual? All right, thanks Emil and Tanya for the interesting discussion on recycling, and hopefully I'm going to take home some more of my recycling and actually throw it away. So next week we're going to be talking about gut bacteria, and that's a topic that I kind of introduced in one of our first episodes where I just talked about the gut microbiome, and I gave you absolutely no information on it or what it was going to be about. So we're going to go through that next week, and hopefully by the end of it you'll know what a transpoojon is. And before we sign off for the night, we'd like to invite all of our listeners to send us feedback on how we're doing, what you like or don't like, or even themes that you would like us to go more in depth in. Do you want to hear about why the sky is blue or what string theory is? Send us an email to radio@ubcsharingscience.org. That's radio@ubcsharingscience.org. Don't be shy, and we won't be either. Stick around next week to hear about gut bacteria, and stick around right now to hear Sam Squanch's Hideaway.